This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
No contracts, no strips.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. When the Writers Guild of America went on strike earlier this month, we saw the effect immediately on the late-night comedy institutions, which went dark right away.
This show will be interrupted, and we won't be here to spend time with you.
But as the strike goes on, the future of many scripted shows will also become uncertain. At issue is the revenue generated by streaming services. On the one end of the bargaining table, the big studios don't seem inclined at all to capitulate to the WGA's demands. The last time the Writers Guild hit the picket line, it was 2007, and that strike carried over into the following year and lasted 100 days. It reportedly cost the city of Los Angeles hundreds of millions of dollars, and this year's strike has the potential to last even longer.
Once the studios broke our business, we've been left with crumbs, and we have to say no to that. We have to stand up together, and we are united.
Fists up, hands down. LA is a union town. Fists up, hands down.
Staff writer Michael Shulman has been covering the strike for The New Yorker, and he recently spoke to Laura Jackman, a veteran TV writer and a strike captain, about the stakes.
Well, tell me about what the scene is like on the picket line. Where were you picketing?
I was mostly at Amazon / Culver Studios this week. So you're passing both studio people and you're passing just people on their way to lunch. And it's electric. The mood is electric. You know, we're walking in circles, but we're also getting cars honking at us as we pass. We're doing our chants. The solidarity has been incredible to see and to experience.
So getting a little more serious about what this strike is actually about, when we spoke a week or two ago, you said this is an existential fight for the future of the business of writing. And if we do not dig in now, there will be nothing to fight for in 3 years. What do you mean by that?
So we're on strike for a fair deal from the studios that is going to allow us to share in the success of the content we create and something that makes writing a sustainable career. It has been chipped away at, is one way of putting it. Eviscerated is another way of putting it. So this month marks my 10-year anniversary in the Guild. I'll have been a Guild member for 10 years in just a couple weeks. And I've seen the offers for staffing go from 20 weeks extendable to 15 weeks, 12 weeks, 10 weeks, 8, 7, 6. So the same amount of television is still being written, the same amount of television is still being produced, but they're asking us to write more of it in a shorter time period for significantly less money. And that, I think, is the thing that really represents the threat to our business overall.
And how does that translate in terms of how a writer makes a sustainable living? Like if you, it seems like it used to be when you were on, you know, a network show, you had a 22 episode season and you were basically employed for an extended period of time and then you get residuals. This doesn't seem like that at all.
No, our structure of compensation used to be that you were getting paid to do the writing in the writer's room. You were getting paid to cover prep, production, and post-production. And then on the back end, you were getting something called residuals, which is the money that you make as long as the studio is still making money off of that content. So any rerun that you see on television, you know, months or years after the fact, a writer is getting paid for that. Those are things that we struck for. And they have sort of said, okay, now that we're all streaming, now that we've broken the business of how your compensation works, we're going to ask you to accept a lesser residual or almost no residual. We're not going to pay to have writers cover prep, production, and post-production. And we're going to whittle down these rooms into something called mini rooms.
Right. Mini
so that
rooms
we're employing
I've been hearing a ton about.
Yes.
Can you explain what those are? What that means, mini room?
So there is no such thing as a mini season of television, right? When we watch a season of television, we're watching a beginning, middle, and end, whether that's 8 episodes, 10 episodes, or 22 episodes. And they're saying, we want the same amount of episodes. We want a full season, but we want you to do it way faster. And we want you to sort of come in, give us a blitz of content and scripts, and then we're going to cut off your pay.
Now, this is very different than the concept of the television writers' room that I think a lot of people thought existed. And I want to go back and talk about your earliest experiences working in TV. So you came out to Hollywood about 10 years ago, right? Can you tell me a bit about what brought you there and what your first job was like?
My first job was an ABC Studios, ABC Network show called Lucky Seven. And the process of getting staffed is, you know, you pay on your own dime to fly out to LA. You do a water bottle tour. So you go around, you take all these meetings with studios and networks and producers and showrunners. And then hopefully at the end of it, you have an offer to staff. So that's what it was like for me. I spent weeks doing these meetings. And then at the end of it, I had less than 5 days to pick up my whole life, fly out to
where?
Los Angeles. I was in Chicago at the time.
Working as a playwright, right?
Working as a struggling playwright, working as a working, I say that, that's in generous terms, right? Working, trying as a playwright. It was come out to Los Angeles, find a second apartment to sublet because I still had my place in Chicago, and then sit in a room with a bunch of lovely people and break a series of television together. And it was exactly what a writer's room experience is supposed to be. Unfortunately, we got canceled after our second airing. We got canceled after our second episode. It's the full Hollywood experience for me inside of 20 weeks. but it was the old model, which recognized that not only are we being compensated for our labor in the moment, but we're being trained for the future. We're being trained as up-and-coming showrunners on our own.
Right. So in the intervening 10 years, a lot has changed about the TV industry. And one of the things seems to be that it's a lot harder for writers to get experience to be on set. Can you explain sort of how that has changed?
So part of that is because of the mini room. If you're only employing writers for 6 weeks, first of all, those scripts are not done. Those scripts are not locked, and those scripts are not ready to shoot after 6 weeks. Many, many more things have to happen after that. And often it's on individual showrunners to be writing and revising those scripts on their own for weeks or months before prep starts in earnest. So the shorter the room, the farther apart it's separated from the process of production, the smaller the chance that those writers who wrote those episodes will get to engage in the full process of production.
Right. Now, you're not only a longstanding member of the Guild, but you've also been a contract captain and now a strike captain. So you've been talking to a lot of members. Can you tell me about sort of what you're hearing from people and what you were hearing from people before the strike was called? Like, what's the mood? What are people bringing up when you talk to them?
The word that I would use in the lead up is desperation. That people are really desperate. And it has become what once was a path to a middle-class career has really become a sort of moonshot, that people are falling through the cracks, that they're not able to ascend that ladder, that they're not able to make a career out of this. And after 3 years of COVID, going on 4 years of COVID, I think the American public, I think the world has seen the companies are reaping massive profits off of the value of labor. And our labor is standing up and saying, not on our backs. You got to compensate us. You got to pay us fairly.
Now, in terms of how long this is going to go on, the previous WGA strike in 2007 to 2008 was 100 days. The one before that, 1988, was over 150 days. But the conditions are different this time. And people like Ted Sarandos from Netflix have said, well, basically, you know, we have a big backlog of stuff. We can just roll that out. And so there's a feeling that the studios might have more leverage than they even had previously and can kind of wait this out. Do you think that's true? And what do you see happening? When do you see this kind of hitting the point of, you know, we have no shows left to show?
So they say a lot of stuff, right? They say a lot of stuff. They tell us that they can't afford the cost of us. And simultaneously, they're on their public earnings calls, trumpeting bright financial futures to their shareholders. So they say a lot, and then we see that what they say might not be completely true. What I can tell you is we are shutting down productions daily. We are halting productions and plans for production daily. We are turning back Teamster trucks. Local 399, we owe a huge debt to, that they are driving up to the studio gates, they are seeing our picket lines, and they are waving and turning away. The brave IATSE members, right, who are not getting paid for that day that they were supposed to work, are seeing our picket lines and turning around. And the fact is that we are not alone this time. Every single Hollywood guild and union has come out in solidarity. The DGA, SAG-AFTRA, IATSE, the laborers, the plasterers, the Teamsters, they were all with us at the membership meeting at the Shrine Auditorium on Wednesday. And the Shrine has these old wooden floors, and people were stomping, people were clapping. It was ovation after ovation, because we recognize the sacrifice in the solidarity that everyone else is pledging to us. And that is what is different this time.
No contracts, no scripts. No contracts, no scripts. No contracts, no scripts. No contracts, no scripts.
Laura Jackman's credits include the TV adaptation of Get Shorty and Netflix's Grace and Frankie. Michael Shulman is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and this is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Ever since Samantha Irby emerged as a breakout star from the blogosphere, readers have loved her for being an unvarnished truth-teller. On her blog and in her best-selling books of essays, Irby exposes a lot, from her battles with Crohn's disease to her addiction to QVC.
My passion is to truly make, like, dirtbag, slacker, black lady stuff, because there is not enough, like, you know, this black lady doesn't have ambition art in the world, and I'm going to try and get it out there.
Recently, Irby made the leap into writing for television on shows like Hulu's Shrill and HBO's Sex and the City reboot, and Just Like That. Doreen Sanfelix, a staff writer for The New Yorker, sees Irby as the ideal chronicler of what she calls the malaise of the millennial condition. When Doreen sat down to talk with Samantha Irby, it was 3 days into the Writers Guild strike.
What changes have happened in the industry that have caused, you know, writers to take the stand that they're taking?
I think the biggest change, and we all know it because it's changed our lives so much, is streaming and the way and sort of the opacity that the producers and studios work under, that, like, you don't even know the ways you're being screwed, right? You just know that, like, your checks are smaller. But the other day I got a residual check from, it was based on my episode from And Just Like That. So big network. We know a lot of people watched it. My residual check was $40. And it's like, you hear about, like, people who worked on like Law and Order, right? Like,
right,
things that are, like, so syndicated. And they're having a great, they haven't written anything in 20 years, but they're having a great life off those residual checks. That is not possible for writers right now. And I think what makes me feel the worst is, like, there are, like, young, super young people in this industry trying to, like, cobble together, like, enough writing jobs to, like, have writing be their only job, and they can't do that. I was reading a thing about how this person, I can't remember who it was, this writer, the day they found out they got nominated for an Emmy, they were in Target applying for a job. And it's like, we get that that is the reality. Like, I worked in, like, customer service for, like, 15 years, right?
Right.
But I feel like when I was making $15 an hour, like bagging donuts, my boss wasn't making $200 million that she refused to share with me.
That would be a very weird donut shop.
It was like, but you know, so like the disparity between you and your regular boss is one thing, right? It's like, maybe they have a newer version of the same car you drive, but the difference between the writer's take-home pay and the executive's take-home pay is bonkers. Because, you know, like, Hollywood is weird. If they have their way, you would just move to L.A. immediately, mm-hmm. be mm-hmm. in meetings every 5 minutes. Never sleep, always be hustling. But I think, like, one of the things about coming into this work at 43, I do not have the stamina to hustle. I'm like, oh, I'll have one job. And when that job ends, I'll wait till someone asks me to do another job. So I think all of, like, my fake curmudgeonliness and like physical distance has kept me feeling like the same person.
Right, right.
Even though like Cynthia Nixon texted me, you know what I mean? It's like, that's her. She's fancy and she lives in my phone. That's not me.
I'd be curious to hear about, you know, how being in the space of the writer's room where it's a collaborative environment kind of works with or maybe works against your very much one person kind of essay writing that you do.
I think that TV writing is hard, but also is like maybe the easiest because you have other people to bounce things off of. So like in my own work, I have complete confidence in my brain, right? Mm-hmm. I'm like, this is what I'm going to write about. This is how I'm going to form it. Like, this is the format that feels right, like a list or whatever. And then I write it and then I fix it with my editor and then it's good. And I feel good about that. Like having a book out in the world, I feel good and confident in what's in it. Mm-hmm. With TV, because I don't fully understand TV and I haven't been doing it long enough to feel like I know what I'm doing, I appreciate the collaboration because I think it all helps to keep me from looking stupid, which is like my biggest fear is like looking like an idiot. So it's nice to have someone, like if I throw out an insane pitch, to have someone be like, well, that wouldn't work because this, or right. An audience doesn't like that. Or, I mean, even something as basic as like, you know, we have to keep this thread going throughout the episode and you forgot it. Also, like, the writer's room is just like the beginning. Then it's like the showrunner,
right.
And then it goes to the network. The first time I saw an episode of television I wrote, there was lots of stuff on the screen that I didn't write.
And what episode was that? Was it in Works
It was
and Talkers?
Shrill. It was the pool party episode of Shrill.
Mm-hmm.
And there, when I wrote the script, and you write from an outline that kind of everybody puts together, there was no fight with the boyfriend in my episode. Hmm. And I was like, good. You know, I'm like, we don't need any men. And then I see the episode and there's a scene I didn't write. And that just sort of... And I wasn't like offended or embarrassed or anything.
Right.
It's just like, oh yeah, okay, that's how it works. What I turn in then goes through so many hands that like, it resembles what I wrote, but maybe not. Jokes get punched up and scenes get taken out like for time. So I think with TV, I enjoy the collaboration only because it further helps me, like, let go of control. But in TV, you're just going to get your feelings hurt over and over and over if you like stay married to literally anything you put in a script.
Coming into this conversation, I had this idea that Sam Irby and I would begin by talking about her memoir and then talk seriously about writer's rooms and just like that. And of course, all of that went out the window as soon as she began to speak.
A real sticking spot for me, or like a real sensitive spot for me, is I have always felt, and it gets worse, I think, as my career gets better with not having a college degree, right? Mm-hmm. Like I just am, it makes me feel, especially with writing, you know how writers are. They're like, what MFA program that did you go to?
Pedigree.
And I'm like, oh, I went to high school. I don't even have a bachelor's degree. I certainly don't have an MFA. And like people who are all chummy from their grad school programs and, you know, they exclude. And then you add to it that I write a lot of filth and it makes people take me less seriously. So because I have thought of myself as like undereducated, whenever anyone has criticized my choice in book to read, I have the feeling of like, oh, I guess I didn't know any better that this was a bad thing to consume.
Right.
And I don't want to feel bad because some random person wanted to make me feel bad. Since I started doing I Like It, which is like, let's say you're reading Gone Girl, which is one of my favorite books. And I don't think it's trashy, but some people do. And someone says like, oh, that book is bad for women. First of all, am I going to give a feminist lecture off the top of my head to some asshole who just wants to be rude to me? No, I'm physically incapable. But what I can do is go, oh, well, I like this book. And then the person does not expect you to say that. They're basically standing there waiting for you to apologize to them for liking something that they don't deem worthy. And then it gets a little awkward. And then I just keep doubling down. I just keep going, I like it.
Right.
And it has been, it's a tiny, handy tool to just like get people off you. I feel like right now, and I don't know if it's social media or just a general hostility in the air, but like everyone is just like waiting to judge you.
Right.
But for something that doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Like nobody's seen me kicking a puppy, right? Or yelling at a kid. Those are the kinds of things I'd be worried about, like someone finding out about me. Not that I am deep into all the Real Housewives, you know? And like the fact that I also, this is a thing with you as a critic. It's like, I know you, I trust you. If you say everything you say about a thing, I'm like, I know this person. I trust her. I believe what she says about this show. I trust her analysis, like the whole thing. Joe Blow on the street, like they're not a trained critic. They don't know how to consume things in a critical way. They're as stupid as I am. I'm going to feel bad because they like don't want me to read John Grisham. No, I refuse. I refuse. There are so many things to feel bad about, and I do. Taking back my taste,
yeah.
Defending my taste is a thing that is worth it to me. I'm going to start standing up for the things that make me happy.
Yeah.
I love Billions.
Billions?
I mean, I watch Succession, too.
But they're both...
Billions is good.
Right, and they both are doing, like, actually very different things. And it makes me wonder, like, what your relationship is to the real fever that got like you know, created when And Just Like That came out. Because there was so, and you talk about this in the essay collection as well, but there was a real, like, you know, this is our baby. You have to do right by our baby, even though you guys had a different mandate that you were pursuing.
Even as a Sex and the City, like, bona fide super fan, I was not ready for, like, the fire hose of opinions and also, and, like, the bad, you know, reviews and recaps or whatever. Like, I am the last name on the writer list. Like, I decide nothing. I had to unsubscribe from people's newsletters.
Oh, gosh.
I was listening to this NPR podcast. I was in the shower, so I didn't see it was going to the next episode, which was about And Just Like That. So I'm listening on my little shower speaker because I'm fancy. And at one point, like, one of the women on the panel is like, were there any Black people in the room? And the host is like, you know, Samantha Irby was in there. She's Black. And the person says, well, all skin folk ain't kinfolk.
Wow.
When I tell you I almost fell out of the shower, and, like, that is the kind, like, okay, I am not Black enough to this person who has no idea who I am, and I didn't bring any changing Blackness into the room. I have betrayed the entire race by not taking over the show and casting all Black people. And it's like, when people go to things like that, it's like, what can you do?
Right.
I can't call that girl and be like, oh, so actually, I'm a Black Panther. You know what I mean? Like, there's nothing to do. So it was so overwhelming. It was so overwhelming.
You were so important in your anticipation of what body positivity did to a lot of people in terms of their, you know, actually making much more grotesque their relationships to their bodies because it mm-hmm. did not allow them to have honesty. Yeah. About how it is that they feel about, like, living in this meat sack.
Yeah.
And one of your pieces that I love is your profile of Lizzo in Time, because here's this person who is so, as you had, you know, really beautifully articulated this idea of body negativity, which is kind of mm-hmm. tongue-in-cheek, but also very mm-hmm. real. And then there you are being set against, you know, just, like, the absolute patron saint of body positivity. And I love that, like, little tension there.
Yeah, that was tough for me because, and I wonder, I sometimes vacillate between, like, am I jealous or is what they're doing wrong, right? Hmm. Because I would never be in my underwear in any photograph ever, right? Like, I would never be photographed with a tank top on. That is not the relationship I have with my body. And I have no problem with other people who do, like, no outward problem, but I do feel like some resentment because I'm not that way, right? I'm like, these people are out in bikinis and they're having a great time. I cannot do that. I hate her, you know, not hate, but you know what I mean?
Right.
So when they approached me about talking to Lizzo, I was just like, I'm not going to turn it down. It's Time magazine, but also.
So this was a profile of Lizzo that Time reached out to.
Yeah, it was their 100 notable something
like that.
Most important
people in the world.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And I'm certainly not going to inject a whole lot of, but you can't love your body all the time, right? You know, Time magazine was not wanting that from me. And I feel like if no one talks about the stuff that's bad or the stuff they don't like, or that they woke up this morning and their shoulder hurts and they wish they had a different body, it's like, there has to be space for all of that. The you go girl of it all, and this is not about Lizzo, but just in generally, is so hard, especially when you consider like accessibility for very fat people, right? Medical care for very fat people. I think that's a thing that we lose in the body positivity of it all is, you know, you see somebody with a burrito belly, you know, in a bathing suit, and it's like, oh, that's so brave. And like, great, maybe it is, but why are airplane seats so small? And why, you know, why are theaters like made for like people in the 1920s mm-hmm. or whatever? It's like,
vanity sizing is another thing, right?
Oh my God, it's so real. And I think sometimes that people think like the struggle is over because we see fat women in bathing suits on our feeds and like Old Navy is making, you know, 4X or whatever. And I think like with those kind of, with putting the lipstick on the pig, as it were, no pun intended, is great. I love the visuals. I went to Target and saw my girl in one of their jeans ads on the wall. I was very excited. But then you can't like buy the size clothes she wears in the store because they don't stock the fat clothes. So then as a fat person, you got to remember what you liked. Go home, see if they make it in your size, get it, have it fit weird, send it back. You know what I mean? It just is like, truly my only beef with the like love yourself of it all is that you're trying to in a society that hates your guts. I was listening to, I don't even know, some podcast, and the host was talking about how like, you know, white men are the last people it's acceptable to make jokes about. And I was like, okay, sir, there are fat jokes everywhere in everything that you watch all the time. There's no warning. You'll be watching a soap opera and then somebody will like say something. It's like, it's in the culture. It's people on the street will say things to you. It's just like, I don't want everything to be boiled down to like whether you're okay wearing shorts outside in the summer.
Right, right.
Because that's like the least of the issues.
Sam, it was so great to talk with you.
So, this really made my day. You are the best. Gosh. When are we getting a Doreen St. Felix book?
Wait, what? What did you say? Sorry, the feed is dropping up.
The New Yorker's Doreen St. Felix speaking with writer Samantha Irby. Irby's new collection of essays is called Quietly Hostile. HBO's And Just Like That returns for a second season in June. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and we'll be back with more in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
I try not to be alarmist, but I feel like there's some sort of apocalypse that's awaiting around climate change. I fear for people who are living below sea level. I fear for people who are very dependent on agriculture. And I can just go to the grocery store, so I have a little bit more time. I have a stable income. But, I mean, calamity can come at any time.
I think we're getting towards a point where we're not going to be able to reverse the damages to the climate that we make. And I'm a little bit worried to see what the consequences of that might be in the future, especially when I'm thinking about, you know, do I want to have kids? Is this a world I want to bring them into? Is it going to be safe for them? I really don't know.
I realize that mankind is a tough species to be part of. But we're doing it to the earth, and we have to change. I have grandchildren, so I think about what their lives will be like when mine is no longer here. And it doesn't seem to me that things are happening quickly.
I mean, I lived in Staten Island for Hurricane Sandy, and that was like, it devastated that borough in New York. And it was just because of like lack of preparedness because of the climate was changing and like the sea levels were rising and people were like, they were drowning in their own homes because of floods. And like, I don't know, seeing that as a kid was just really impacts you.
In June, a case known as Held versus Montana will go to court. It's a lawsuit about the climate emergency, the first ever of its kind to reach trial. 16 young plaintiffs are suing the state of Montana for failing in its obligation under the Montana Constitution to provide them with a healthy environment. And among the harms the plaintiffs will lay out is the emotional distress of watching the world around them get more and more threatened every day. An expert witness the plaintiffs will call in the Held case is the psychiatrist Lisa Van Susteren. She's a co-founder of the Climate Psychiatry Alliance, a network of mental health providers concerned with educating colleagues and the public about the climate crisis. I think it's axiomatic now that we have, in ways that are hard to quantify, a mental health crisis in the United States, and a lot of it is ascribed to the pandemic and its aftermath and any number of other factors, social media. And one of them is the climate crisis. How would you at least broadly outline that crisis where it has to do with climate and psychology?
Well, let me take it from the top. The pandemic created enormous pressures on kids because they weren't able to socialize and do the things that helped them to break away from their parents and adjust to a new world, et cetera. And so the fact that there was additional challenges to kids is undeniable. But for some reason, when it has come to understanding that kids are hearing scientists tell us that we are looking at the extinction of species and maybe even of our own. And unless they're living in a cave, it's going to bother them. So, yeah, we have a very serious mental health crisis in kids. And yes, it is disproportionately on them because they will disproportionately feel the cumulative effect of climate instability.
Is it possible to quantify the crisis, especially when it comes to climate?
The answer, short answer, is no. Anxiety exists in the brain. And think of it as a big, dark, black pool. In that big pool, it is impossible to quantify today. I'm anxious about climate this much, about not looking good that much, and about not getting into the right school a different amount. But here's what I can tell you. I participated in a survey that we launched in 2021 and had the results in the fall. And in it, we surveyed 10,000 kids from 10 countries all over the world. And here's what we found. 3/4 of the kids are worried about the future because of climate. Almost half of them say it affects their daily lives. More than half say they feel a sense of doom about the future. And here's what's interesting to somebody like me, because I'm really focusing on policy. 2/3 of those kids lay the blame firmly at the feet of government.
I grew up with a nuclear threat. I even was probably the last generation of kids who scurried into a hallway or under desks.
Under desk. What was that going to do for us?
Well, the desk was going to prevent you from nuclear annihilation, apparently. And so obviously this fed into our anxiety, but it was kind of inchoate and rarely spoken of. How is this different?
Well, think about it. We, at the time, thought the Soviets or the Russians, it wasn't communists, in my mind, were going to do something really bad. I didn't exactly know, you probably didn't either, what nuclear war was. But that is very different from what the kids know today. If you're a kid today, you can see a fire, a flood, a storm. You can hear about homes and places that have been leveled. Mm-hmm. This is very, it's something that is extremely visual. They can understand at a very grassroots level what this means. Nuclear war and a mushroom cloud, what is that?
You see patients, right?
Sure, I do, Sue. Yeah.
And what do they tell you? What are you hearing directly from kids that you talk to?
So I have spoken with young people extensively, but not as patients. And we need to recognize that we must not pathologize climate distress. Mm-hmm. But kids are talking about their anger. They're talking about their fear. They're talking about their despair. They're talking about feelings of abandonment. They are talking about betrayal. And they don't understand why the adults in the room are not taking more action. So let me just say one thing that is pretty characteristic that I have found, and in many of the most sensitive kids, is what I've dubbed pre-traumatic stress, which is anticipation of future harms and has all the hallmarks of post-traumatic stress, but it's in conjuring what will happen in the future.
You said that we shouldn't pathologize climate distress. What do you mean by that?
Not to think of it as a mental illness. Mm-hmm. If it was to be a mental illness to, if you saw somebody on the tracks and the train was coming, to be alarmed and scream at the person to get off the tracks, well, that's the equivalent.
What you're saying is a logical response to an imminent threat.
It's more than logical. It's a survival strategy.
Mm-hmm.
I started a group called the Climate Aware Therapists because I got so many calls from people who were non-functional. And that's when you can begin to talk about it as an entity that should be recognized within my professional groups as becoming a mental, maybe illness is too strong a term, but a condition.
How prevalent is that?
Mm-hmm. Climate distress itself, I believe we're all anxious now, whether we know it or not, whether we like it or not, whether we admit it or not. But when it reaches the level of a person who is no longer functional, I can't tell you the numbers, but I certainly have heard them anecdotally.
Do you experience it yourself,
climate
anxiety?
Are you kidding? I try to keep it. This is the big quandary. How much of it do I show my family? Like, they don't know. And I've laughed and said very openly, I could open a pharmacy with all of the medications I've had my colleagues prescribe for me to address my climate anxiety. So,
but we've been talking about young people. What you're saying is that people who are in middle age or older obviously feel a climate anxiety. Oh, and how does it differ for them?
Well, first of all, the kids are more attuned to it because they're not the problem. We're, you know, a little bit old dogs, new tricks. Plus, we're used to a high carbon lifestyle and we're not so ready to give it up. So we deny, we disavow and all the rest. But as for our anxiety, for those of us I know, I think one critical key issue is that many of us feel more empowered than kids do. There's something that I can do. I can reach out to legislatures, the new climate chief in Massachusetts. There's a lot I can talk to you. There's mm-hmm. a lot I can do. The kids, basically, you know, they can gather their voices, but they're not empowered. And that helplessness is the worst.
What do you do and what do your colleagues do with young people who are feeling overwhelmed by climate anxiety? How do you help them cope? You can't tell them a political fairy tale.
No, of course you can't. And they won't listen to it. So the remedies, there's a standard remedy, and that is depending upon the age of the child. I once had a patient whose kid thought that Charlie, their dog, was going to die because of extinction of the species. And so, you know, if it's a little kid like that, you say, oh gosh, you know, no, Charlie's safe, etc. But, you know, a 10-year-old is different from a teenager. it might be for a younger child, you'll say, well, let's make a garden so that we can grow our own vegetables. That will help the planet. And you can engage in activities that are age appropriate. If it's a teenager, you might say, I stand by your protest today and not going to school, and do you want me to come with you? So you describe the dangers in a way that's meets their particular stage of development. And then you quickly segue to, here's what we can do about it. And that is the secret sauce to feeling empowered. And empowerment is the secret sauce in reducing anxiety and that feeling of helplessness.
So you're an expert witness in two climate cases, one that sued the federal government and the other against the state of Montana, which is a case scheduled for June. The plaintiffs are young, and some of them are still in their teens. Tell us broadly about what these cases allege and what you were brought in to testify about.
The two cases you're speaking of are Juliana versus the U.S. government, 21 youth plaintiffs, and the climate scientist, James Hansen.
And this is James Hansen, who rang the bell about climate change long ago, as much as 40 years ago.
That is correct. In 1988, right, he testified before Congress about climate and greenhouse gases and what they would cause. So the suit is based on constitutional grounds. We are guaranteed a right to life, liberty, and property. And those three protections are profoundly being challenged by climate disruption. So that's the Juliana case. In Held versus the state of Montana, it's essentially the same format. 16 youth plaintiffs suing the state of Montana. Montana state constitution explicitly says that the residents of Montana have a right to a healthful environment, and they don't have that as a result of their policies that are favoring the fossil fuel industry or fossil fuel exploration, extraction, transport, et cetera, in the state of Montana.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, these are suits, these are actions that are on the level of political action and symbol. What do you hope comes out of them?
Oh,
what's
gosh.
Possible? And what is the discovery process
okay.
like?
I wrote reports cataloging the long list, 25-page report of all of the harms that are coming to kids as a result of climate inaction. I also previously worked for the federal government as a psychological profiler of world leaders. And so I profiled the kids. And by that, I mean I looked at where they are today and made projections about what I thought could befall them in the future as a result of our climate policies, and particularly what could befall them if we fail to take the action that we need to.
Would you want to see insurers cover climate anxiety as a condition, or is that pathologizing things?
But no, yeah, great. And I meant to bring this up before. The reason is so important for us to have professionally ways to describe climate distress is that when we can give it a number, as we do in the diagnostic and statistic manual for insiders, then we can get insurance companies to pay for help with the climate distress that you have. And we can create a way not to suggest that a person is mentally ill, but rather struggling with a very real issue, and that this very real issue can exacerbate pre-existing conditions.
Dr. Van Susteren, thank you so much.
Thank you, David. Thanks for all you do.
Lisa Van Susteren, a co-founder of the Climate Psychiatry Alliance. In June, she'll be testifying on behalf of 16 youth plaintiffs in Held versus Montana. I'm David Remnick, and that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbes of Tune Yards, with additional music by Ngo Fen and Putubuele and Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Brita Green, Adam Howard, Kala Leah, Avery Keatley, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, and Ngo Fen and Putubuele, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Harrison Keithline, Michael May, David Gable, Meher Bhatia, and Alejandra Deckett. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.